Welcome back to A View from the Couch. My name is Rich.
I'm Jen.
And we're gonna dive into the swinging 60s, baby. Yeah, it's gonna be groovy.
All of a sudden you turn into Austin Powers.
Yeah, but we're not talking about Austin Powers, are we? No. Not quite Austin Powers, although it is a British set of characters in the 1960s. At least partially stuck in the 1960s. So we might as well be talking about Austin Powers. Just kidding. Sorry, Edgar Wright. I don't mean to imply in any way, shape, or form that your film Last Night in Soho is an Austin Powers film, because it's not. But it certainly has that feel to it in some situations, doesn't it?
Well, it's the look and the music. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, nothing else.
Not a darn thing, as they say around these parts. So what do you know about the, you know, darn thing. What do you know about this movie before we went into it? What did you, because this was
not
we saw
much.
The first, like, we saw it together first, right?
Yes.
You hadn't seen it before me. I hadn't seen it before you. Did you know anything about it before we jumped in?
No, I had seen the trailer.
Okay.
And I thought it looked interesting.
Okay.
Didn't really know what it was about. Didn't really know who Edgar Wright was, although you kept going on and on about how you love Edgar Wright. And I'm like, yeah, okay.
You're like, I don't know who the hell that is. All
right.
Why don't you just marry him?
But it looked interesting. So I was kind of excited to see it. But I was definitely not as excited as you were to see it.
Oh, man. Edgar Wright. I love Edgar Wright. He did a TV show called Spaced with Simon Pegg way back in the day, like 20 something years ago at this point. I think it was 99, 2000, something like that. It was only on for two seasons. And I didn't see it until much later. I didn't see it until after I had seen his film, Shaun of the Dead, which was that was his breakout flick, right? He is famous for Shaun of the Dead. He's famous for The World's End. He's famous for Hot Fuzz, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. He also adapted The Adventures of Tintin for Steven Spielberg. He was originally supposed to be the director of Ant-Man back in the day. In fact, most of that screenplay that he wrote, or not most of it, but parts of that screenplay that he wrote actually made it into the finished product of the original Ant-Man film. He did Baby Driver. You've seen Baby
I have
Driver.
Seen that one. I've seen There's Shaun a, of the Dead, and I've seen Baby Driver.
Okay. There's a lot of Baby Driver in this movie, and I'll explain that as we go along. But yeah, Edgar Wright. I love Edgar Wright. He has made some of my favorite films of the last 20 years, I would say.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, this movie was, like you said, directed by Edgar Wright. Mm-hmm. It was also written by Edgar Wright and Christy Wilson Carnes. We have starring in here Thomasin McKenzie as Eloise, Anna Taylor-Joy as Sandy, Matt Smith plays Jack. We have Diana Rigg in here as Miss Collins.
Mrs. James Bond herself, the only woman to be named Mrs. James Bond, and also she starred in the film with George Lazenby, which was his only James Bond film. So yeah, Dame Diana Rigg, Mrs. James Bond.
And then we have Michael Ajao playing John.
Okay. Now, do you know who Christy Wilson Carnes is? Do you know what else she's done? She did one other movie that I know you know.
No, I have not heard of her.
1917.
I love that movie.
That movie
was great.
Yeah, that flick was really good. I want to talk about the cinematographer on this flick, though. Chung Chung-hoon is an accomplished cinematographer. This dude worked with Park Chan-wook for years. He filmed his first movie, Old Boy. He did Lady Vengeance, which is the first two parts of the Vengeance trilogy that Park Chan-wook did. He did The Thirst. He did Stoker, which is the American movie that they did. But then he's moved into other, like, more mainstream American films since then. And he did It, Chapter One, with it by Andy Muschietti. He did Hotel Artemis, which, honestly, if you've seen Hotel Artemis, this movie has a lot of the same look. Zombieland Double Tap. Yeah, and this movie. And Uncharted. Now, the look of Old Boy has always been something that I was really appreciative of. And this movie tells me why. It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous flick. But yeah, so.
All right.
Yeah. Well, let's just get into it. Let's just dive in. Why not?
Let's do it.
Yeah. The movie is about a young girl named Eloise Turner, and she is kind of obsessed with the 60s. 60s style, 60s look, 60s music, because of her grandmother. She wants to become a fashion designer, so she goes and applies to the London College of Fashion, and she gets accepted, and then she moves there, but she has a hard time fitting in with her peers, especially Jocasta, who is one name. She wants to have one name because she wants to be famous, Jocasta. And they treat her kind of crappy, right? I mean, they're not very nice to her at all. They're kind of
this group of girls.
Yeah.
Oh, I knew girls like this in high school. My God, it brought back memories.
Right.
Oh, it was tough to watch because I felt like I've been in Eloise's shoes at some of those points. I hate girls like that.
You know what I really, okay, so now just spoilers, guys, because we're gonna spoil the hell out of this movie just like we always do. But this whole relationship between those girls and her relationship with the Terrence Stamp character, who we find out later is a police officer that used to work the red light mm-hmm. district. I wrote down that the people that she trusts at first turn out to be shit, and the people that she doesn't trust turn out to be the nice ones. She doesn't trust John.
Right.
At first, right? She sees him when she's mm-hmm. first walking in. She's, you know, she kind of gives him the side eye, like, oh, I don't want you to try and hurt me. She trusts Jocasta and her friends. And they're the ones that turn out being like absolute shit people. John and Terrence Stamp's character turn out to be good guys, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting that like this whole movie is about flipped perceptions, and they set it up right from the jump,
Mm-hmm.
In that first night out, while they're at the bar with John and with the girls, and they meet the cop, former cop. Yeah, they set that whole thing.
But they don't really meet him that first night. She just sees him over across the street. So
So we as the audience meet him. Yeah.
She makes note of the guy. Yeah.
Right. She doesn't trust
him. We'll talk about him more later when we get into more of the story, I think.
Right. So because of the crappy relationship with her roommate and with the people that she's in with at the school, she decides that she's going to leave the residence hall, which is, you know, where she lives at first. And she goes to move into like a room that's being rented out by an elderly lady, Mrs. Collins or Ms. Collins, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And that first night she has this amazing, like vivid, like dream. It seems like it's a dream at first. We're gonna later find out, like, did you have any idea that this was a haunted house movie?
No,
I had no, no and still clue
even by the time I was done. So honestly, through this movie I was confused and like, what the hell is happening, you know, because they set it up like, yeah, it's just a dream, or maybe it's visions or something mm-hmm. like that. But that first dream, that's what we'll call it for now.
Yeah.
Was very realistic, but my God, it was cool to see. It was neat to see, you know, basically it's almost like she is Sandy,
right?
You know, she is in Sandy's shoes. She's walking it. And I love the fact that once we get through this and she wakes up the next day, she like wakes up with more confidence. You know, she's
right.
Like trying to embody Sandy's confidence here.
Right. But the interesting thing about that is that she's not the haunting. Sandy's not the haunting. We're going to find out that Sandy is actually still alive. Sandy's Miss Collins. But
spoiler alert, don't even
spoiler alert. Yeah.
That till the end.
Well, why the hell should I? Right. I mean, we're here to talk about the movie, right? We're here to talk about the movie. If fuck it, whatever. So
now I want to also talk about this sequence here. Now, this is some trivia stuff, but I'm going to throw this in here right now.
This
mirroring that they were doing,
yeah,
was almost all practical effects.
Right.
So it wasn't a lot of CGI. It wasn't a lot of, you know, editing stuff in and post or anything like that. This was these two actresses mirrored with a green screen being behind one of them, so that way they could put the mirror image in the post. But they're just mirroring each other's actions.
Yeah.
And then while they're dancing with Jack, they're actually, they don't do a lot of cuts and reputs. They're actually both dancing with him and they're like ducking in and out. So you don't actually see them, but it's a lot of choreography going on to try and take it all in one shot there, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing the way they did that, because it is, it's seamless. There's no cuts. It's like there's the, mm-hmm. the dancing scene is literally just the camera kind of going around and, you know, they're ducking in and out, and it's, yeah, it's some great theatrical trickery going on there.
Also, the name of this club, what was the club called, that one, that first one they're in?
Café de Paris.
Okay. So that is an actual club that was in London. Mm-hmm. And Diana Riggs, once they had the set ready, asked if she could, you know, go and see it. And they brought her in and she said it looked amazing. It was very similar. Otherwise, it was just a little bigger, of course, for filming purposes.
Sure.
But she said she remembered when she first went to this club and she walked down those stairs and she said she felt every man's gaze on her like she was a piece of meat. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was interesting that that was the comment she made, because that's what happened to Sandy when she went down, is, you know, everybody was leering at her and eyeing her, you know. So,
well, I mean,
that's interesting little tidbit there.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the crux of the whole thing, right? Like this mm-hmm. whole thing is about Sandy being treated as a piece of meat, right? That's what this that's what this whole story hinges on. And, you know, but you're talking about where she's coming down the stairs and we're seeing like Ellie in the mirror next to her. And then we see Ellie, you know, in the mirror in different mirrors in different spots, you know, mm-hmm. different times. That was very interesting to me. That was kind of what sold me when I was watching the trailer, was this idea that like, oh, is she traveling back to the city? Is she quantum leaping to this lady? What's going on here? You know?
Right. Cause we really don't know what's happening until the end. And so they really kind of lead you along with this very visual interaction between mm-hmm. these two women. So
yeah, it's a great whodunit is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So basically when she wakes up from that initial dream at the Café de Paris, she gets up the next morning and, like you said, she's full of confidence. She goes to class and she designs a dress that's inspired by Sandy's dress in her dream. And Jocasta also finds like a hickey on her neck.
Mm-hmm.
So like,
ooh, how did that happen in a dream?
Right. Right. It has like this Nightmare on Elm Street feel to it at that point, right?
Yeah. Like, wait,
because you can bring something out of your dream. When can you,
right?
Like, you can bring something out of your dream, like a hickey? What? So,
also, I want to ask too, do you think that part of the reason why these four girls are so awful to her is maybe they're jealous of her talent? I mean, she's making her own clothes. She's experience beyond what they're doing. I mean, maybe they're maybe a little jealous of her talent, and maybe that's why they're putting her down a little. I mean, she's definitely an outsider, so I see that's why they're, I'm not saying it's okay, because I don't agree with this at all, but you're just trying to find some kind of motivation as to why she was trying to be so competitive with her right off the bat.
Well, kids are shit. Right.
Ugh,
teenagers are a-holes.
I suppose it could be as simple as that. It's just they were just jerks.
it's true. I mean, teenagers are a-holes, right? So I don't know why I'm saying a-holes. I've dropped the F-bomb like four times already, but whatever, you know, it's for effect.
But don't say the A-word.
I will not say the A-word. Jeez. So where was I going with that? What did you just say? You said something about
teenagers are a-holes.
Yeah, teenagers are a-holes. So that, you know, when you're talking about that, when you're talking about, you know, they're picking on her because they're threatened by her talent, that's, it sounded an awful lot like when I used to get like picked on and teased and get the shit beat out of me at school. My mother would always say, well, they're just jealous. I don't know, Ma. I don't think that's the reason. I think they're just a-holes. I don't know if they're, what are they jealous of, Mom? Exactly. Are they jealous of my ability to just talk incessantly about nonsensical bullshit? That's probably what they're jealous of. Yeah, you're right. You're onto something. Anyway, so she keeps having these dreams though, right? So as she's dreaming, she's seeing Sandy's story play out. Sandy auditions at a nightclub in Soho. Jack helped her get in there. And, you know, there's like all kinds of different things happen there. And then of course, in present day, Ellie starts to change her hairstyle, change the way she dresses to feel a little more like Sandy, because she feels like, you know, she's an inspiration for her, right? She even goes and gets a job at a local pub to start, you know, start basically being able to like pay for some of her stuff, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. And as we progress further, we start to realize that Sandy is not there to be a singer. Like the first clue is she's there to be a backup dancer. And then later we start to learn that she's being pimped out.
Mm-hmm.
So she's a sex worker, and not intentionally, just gradually coerced into it, and then eventually threatened into it.
Mm-hmm.
There's this scene. I really liked this scene, which actually sets up who Terrence Stamp's character is. All these different Johns are coming by and asking her what her name is, and she keeps giving a different name each time, but they always say, oh, that's a lovely name. What a lovely name. What a lovely name, right? During that, we find out, we see that there's a young person who asks her her name and says, you know, maybe you should think about getting out of here while you still can, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that that's the Terrence Stamp character. Oh, spoiled it again, but that's the Terrence Stamp character, and he is a cop. This is where it starts to kind of, things kind of start to merge a little bit, right? Like the past and the present start to merge here, because Ellie starts to feel a little less safe in these visions or these dreams that she's having. And Jack...
Well, she's gotten grabbed in some of these now.
Right, right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So like, that's where like, it's starting to turn from fantasy to reality almost, right? And she goes to a Halloween party with John, but she gets like accosted by ghosts there, and John takes her back to her room, basically her place.
So with that at the party thing,
yeah,
how much of that do you think was visions and how much do you think was whatever the heck those nasty girls put in her drink?
Well, they try to play that off as there was something in the drink, right?
Yeah.
But John's not affected. John was drinking the drink too.
Yeah, that's true. But
I don't think there was anything in there. No, I don't think there was anything in the drink.
Well,
I think,
why are they acting the way they're acting? Like, you know, all sly and giggly that she's drinking this thing.
Give her some booze and she'll just start acting like a crazy person, right? Don't they even say that early on? Like, oh, look, she's just a regular tart, just like, you know, just like all of them or whatever, you know, just give her some booze. That's all she needs, right?
Yeah, they made some crude comment earlier. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's really all it is. They're just looking to see her make an ass of herself. But of course, they don't realize that she's being haunted. So
yeah,
there's that. But so they go back to, John takes her back to her flat, and she has a vision of Jack murdering Sandy that night. So she decides to track down the silver-haired man, Terrence Stamp's character. She thinks that he is Jack. So she goes to the
cops.
This
whole situation here could have been solved by her just trying to find out what the dude's name was.
Yeah, she could have asked him who he was, right?
Yeah.
Or even like, it turns out that the lady that she works with at the bar knows who he is and knows that he was a cop. Like,
well, wouldn't anybody there know who he is? Because they say he's a regular there. He's there all the time. Mm-hmm. Just ask any of your coworkers.
Right.
But I do have to say he was acting very shady. He was acting really shady for being the good guy. So
I'm not sure what his motivation was in present day.
No,
it just seemed unclear. He was just like, he makes comments that could be interpreted either way. Like, oh yeah, they're all happy and first or whatever, you know, and it doesn't make that. I think that's my one qualm with this film, as far as characters go, is that he's deliberately
sketchy.
He's deliberately double entendred. He's deliberately left to interpretation when easily he could be interpreted. He could easily be, you know.
But if you do that, you kind of ruin the ending of the whole thing. So, I mean, I understand why it's there and why he's like that for the story purposes. It's just, it seems like,
well,
maybe you could get there another way.
Do you ruin the end that way? I don't think you ruin the end that way. The end is still the same.
Yeah, maybe.
Right? We'll get to that. Let's think about it.
I think he could maybe have been a hair less sketchy and it probably would have been just fine. But he just was just really weird through the whole thing.
Maybe as he got older, he was just like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm not going to tell anybody anything straight up anymore. I'm just going to be
cryptic with all my messages. I'm going to be
as cryptic as possible. Maybe he just hated teenagers and he was like, watch me fuck with them. Here we go. Watch this. Yeah, all the girls, they be loving it here until they don't. Like, she's like, what? He's like, yeah, I'm gonna go have another drink, huh? And then he waits for her in the bar, right? We'll get to that part. So she goes to the cops. Of course, the cops are like, you know, they don't take her seriously. They're just like, yeah, no, okay, whatever.
I don't blame them though. She sounds crazy.
She does sound crazy, right? And then she goes to the library at the school to investigate. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, but this film, this present day part of the film, is taking place in 2020, 2021, something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is she using microfiche? Like, she's straight up using the microfiche machine.
Well, they're at a fashion school. Would the fashion school even have like news articles like that in their library?
I don't think it's like specifically the school's library. I think it's a library that the school other universities, okay. I think, use that same
library. Okay, that makes more sense because I'm like...
Because there's that moment. Sense. Yeah, there's that moment where she shows her ID and she wants the documentation or the newspaper articles about the girls who have died or whatever. And the guy behind the counter is like, aren't you a fashion student? And she's like, yeah, it's for a thing. I'm doing a thing about like girls that got dead and I'm going to make, you know, fashion.
Do they even have those type of machines anymore at the library? I haven't been to a library in so long. I don't know.
I have been to a library, but I don't think I've seen a microfiche machine since I was in college. And that was 25 years ago.
Well, how do you look up old newspapers then like that? Do they have them on like internet or do they have like scanned into a system somewhere?
I don't know. Hmm. I mean, now, okay.
I'm probably curious enough to go look myself, but
now I haven't done any investigative journalism, so I don't really know where you go to look this stuff up, but I've got to assume that some of this stuff, at least most of this stuff, has been digitized, especially in a large city like London, where you've got multiple universities using the same library. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You digitize it. It's not like one person can check out an entire box of microfiche and nobody else can use that until they're done. If you digitize it, everybody can use it at once, you know? Like, I've got to believe that this is some sort of like necessity of the plot that it was on microfiche. I don't know exactly why, because it doesn't ever come into play, but she definitely...
I'm going to talk about something later that it maybe kind of does, but
really?
I think it's more of a visual part of what's happening. So,
okay. All right. Yeah. We'll get to that then, I guess. So she goes and she tries to find these newspaper reports, and then she starts having like visions again. Spirits start to manifest and she starts running around with like scissors and she almost stabs Jocasta. And Jocasta runs off to like tell the cops or tell the security people. And John takes her and runs her out of there. And we never get any resolution to that at all. We never
well,
get
that's
any resolution
not important.
To that at all. But there's no resolution to the Jocasta stuff at all, because she's a constant mm-hmm. antagonist, and we never see any resolution at all to that.
No.
Which I would say
it might be on the cutting room floor somewhere.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, this was a long movie, right?
It was.
It wasn't long. It was 2 hours, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to have like a 2.5 hour movie, maybe it's out there. We didn't watch the deleted scenes, though, so maybe it's in there, you know?
Yeah, could be.
Who knows? But anyway, so after she leaves the library, she goes to work, and downstairs at work is the silver-haired man, the cop. And he's waiting for her, and he's got this, like, this is where he's being creepy again. This is where I have to believe that this guy is like, I'm just going to fuck with teenagers, kids that are just going to college. I'm going to mess with them. And
do you think though that he somehow suspects something's going on, because he knew Sandy and she has a picture drawing of Sandy. She colored her hair and was wearing clothes that right. made her look like Sandy. Do you think that maybe he suspected something?
If he knows Sandy, he knows where Sandy lives too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So like, okay, but see when Eloise comes in, now I don't know if he just put a bunch of like pence in, you know, like 25 pence pieces or whatever into the jukebox and just played the same song over and over until she came in, because how would he have known that she was going to be there at a specific time? Because the song Eloise is playing when she walks in.
Well, she was late for work because they asked her where she was
when
she came in. So maybe he knew she was coming. So kept playing it over and over until she got there.
Right. So she confronts him, and he denies that he killed Sandy, and he tells her that Alex killed Sandy. So he leaves the pub, and she chases him out of the pub and starts shouting at him in the middle of the street. And of course he gets hit by a taxi. And that's when the big reveal happens, that the pub owner says the guy's name is Lindsay, and he's an undercover officer, undercover vice officer. Right. And that's when Ellie starts to remember, oh, wait a minute, that name sounds familiar. This is the guy that tried to get Sandy mm-hmm. to leave the life.
Tried to help Sandy.
Yeah. The life of a sex worker. Right. So
now, I thought that him getting hit there was interesting, because it seemed to me like it was the same spot that she almost got hit when she was trying to get away from him the first time.
Right.
And then of course now he's trying to get mm-hmm. away from her, and he gets hit.
There's so much of this film is all about reflection, right? There's mm-hmm. camera shots that work in like puddles on the street. Just a really well shot, really well choreographed film in that way. But yes, that is the same spot that she's standing in towards the beginning of the film, probably mm-hmm. beginning of the second act, when he says, you want to keep out of the street, you're going to get hit by a car. Of course, that's what happens to him.
Yeah,
we never find out what happens, if he's alive or dead, though. So it doesn't.
He looked pretty dead.
He looked pretty messed up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she decides she's going to leave London. John takes her back to Mrs. Collins's house, where she tells Mrs. Collins that even though she said
Ms.
she was
Collins,
gonna leave, Ms. Collins, sorry, not Mrs. Ms. Collins. She tells her that even though she said she wasn't going to leave in the middle of the night, she's leaving in the middle of the night. And Mrs. Collins or Ms. Shit, Ms. Collins.
I think it's a very important distinction
in this
movie. Yes,
it is. I don't know why I keep saying Mrs. That's like, what the hell's the matter with me? Anyway. So Ms. Collins says that the cops came looking for her and they did like a welfare check on Ellie, right? Because they were worried about her. Even though they didn't take mm-hmm. her seriously, they still went and like... was.
I'm
like,
guessing it was the female cop that went and checked, because she seemed probably. Concerned about her.
Yeah, yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah. The male cop is just kind of like,
a dick.
Yeah. Sorry.
He was
lady.
Making fun of her
he was,
in the
yeah.
bathroom. It was like, he was. Okay.
Yep. Yeah. He was joking with other male cops.
Yeah.
The female cop, when you pan away from that, the female cop's like, oh God, sorry about them. They're just kind of a-holes. I apologize. You know, like she didn't say it, but just like the look on her face says that everything.
Well, and then she takes her aside and just tries to give her some
advice.
And yeah.
Right. So she reveals that she herself is Sandy. we get the big reveal. That's the big, big reveal, that she is Sandy. Mm-hmm. And she explains that the visions of Sandy's death was actually a vision of Sandy killing Jack when he threatened her with a knife.
All right, let's hold up right here.
Did you
see this coming? Did you see that Sandy was?
Yes, I did.
That Miss Collins was Sandy.
Yep, I did. My note here, and I.
When did you pick up on that?
26 minutes into the movie.
Shut the front door.
I will not. Do you remember me pausing the movie or pulling?
Yes,
up
I
the
do.
Thing?
I was like, yeah. What are you doing?
I wanted to make sure because I wrote it down. It was 26 minutes, 4 seconds. I said, Sandy is the old lady. She's lived there for a long time.
So even when you they had the visions of her dying, you still were like, no.
I was like, no, that's her. Either she's a ghost, because there's ghosts, right? We've already had all these other ghosts. She could be a ghost. Who the hell knows?
That's right? True. Yeah.
But yeah.
I did not see it. And so when she said that, I was like, it caught me off guard. I was not anticipating that. So now, it was, for me, it was a great reveal.
It was a great reveal. Don't get me wrong. It was a great reveal. Now, my red herring was Lindsay. I thought Lindsay was Jack. I thought Terrence Stamp's character was Jack. And I wrote that down as well, because he was, because of the way he was acting so menacingly, right? And again, here we have this like flipped version of everything, right? The cop, the kindly cop from the 60s is acting all menacingly, right? The sexy, suave, promiscuous Sandy from the 60s is this old conservative, no boys after 8 o'clock lady in the present day. It's all about flip sides and other images and A side versus B side, because of course we got music everywhere. This movie is all about opposites and like circling the truth. It's fantastic in that way. So that's what was going on. It wasn't actually Sandy getting killed. It was Sandy killing Jack. Now, why the vision appeared to be Jack killing Sandy instead of the flip, I don't know. Although the one thing that I can think of is the spirits are the ones that are giving her the visions. Mm-hmm. And if the spirits are all the men that she's murdered, because it turns out Sandy's a fucking serial killer, guys. She's been murdering Johns left and right since she was put into this position, which, you know, you can almost kind of empathize with. She was forced into this life of prostitution. So she's been murdering Johns, and they're the ones that manipulated the dreams, I think, so that it looks like Sandy was killed.
Yeah, but that would make
to what end?
Them, I don't know. I feel like the spirits were there and kind of showing her stuff, but she was also leading some of this with her imagination too. So I would think, because she definitely sided with Sandy from the get-go,
that Sandy would just be the victim.
That I feel like she would also kind of be seeing it as Sandy as the victim. Yeah. So it could be a little bit of both, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know. That part was a little weird after, when you're kind of thinking about it back later, but.
Right. Right. So she's been hiding the bodies in the floorboards after then. I mean, like, that is some serious serial killer vibes right there, right? Like, killing them, putting them in the floorboards. How does that house not stink? I don't know.
Oh, she says it does, though. Don't you remember her telling her that? Okay.
Oh, so yeah.
I've got
that's
some
right.
foreshadowing stuff I'm going to talk about when we're done.
No.
I've got several foreshadowing things.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right, though. Now that I think about it, she says that you'll smell the bakery and it smells horrible.
No, that's not what she said. I'll talk about it later.
Tell me that part now. Tell me that part now.
Okay,
I don't want to wait.
So,
I want to know now.
So at the beginning, when she's showing Ellie the house, she tells her that during the summer you'll have to keep the drains plugged because the smell drifts up through the house.
Oh shit, you're right. She
does
tell her
there's a bad smell up through the house.
Oh, that's right. Oh shit, you're right. Oh man, it was there the whole time. That's the beauty of it.
It
was there
on that one right away. Because as soon as she said that, I'm like, oh, that's why the house stinks. Because I thought that was a weird comment for her to make at the beginning.
Oh God, yikes! So she drugs Ellie She gives her some tea, but she, you know, she's, of course, she's being kindly Ms. Collins at that point. She gives Ellie some tea that's drugged, and she's going to kill her to make sure she doesn't tell anybody who she is and who she's been murdering, because she can't, she's not going to jail, basically. I ain't going back to the Huskow, right? So, so Ellie, of course, manages to overwhelm her, but like a cigarette ends up in a box of records and ignites it and starts the whole place on fire, right? Mm-hmm. John comes to Ellie's aid, but Ms. Collins stabs him. And then Ellie runs upstairs and is pursued into the, or pursued to the room by Ms. Collins. And there is where we get the spirits kind of converging on Ellie. Like, this is where they all, and they've got this creepy fucking like face thing going on, right? Where their faces are covered and like not covered and then covered again.
Now that is something that I think is a little interesting, because she sees these guys as faceless men.
Right.
And Ms. Collins mentions that she would see them as faceless men because she just would blur out their face or whatever. So that's obviously what Ellie was keying in on. But if the ghosts were showing themselves to her, why would they be blurring out their faces if that's actually how Ms. Collins saw them?
There, but see, now they weren't constantly blurred out, though, right? Because there were
weren't all the time.
It was like their real face was fighting to get over what Ellie's interpretation of them was.
But how was that in her? Yeah, I don't know. I thought that was interesting. I've kind of sat and thought about that a little bit, like trying to make sense of that. My brain hasn't quite clicked on that yet, but I felt like she was seeing what Ms. Collins did, you know, what she did, like she blurred them out. She didn't see faces. It was just a human body.
Yeah.
And that's what Ellie was seeing. But then how was Ellie seeing that when she wasn't seeing Sandy's visions?
Right.
She
right.
Seeing the men's hauntings, I think, maybe. I don't know. That's,
they're the spirits, but here's my interpretation of it. The way that I took this was, this is Ellie struggling with the truth versus what she has been told, right? Like what she believed to begin with versus what's real, right? Like these men are just faceless, you know, abusers of Sandy, but they're also victims who were real people, right? So like that's why it felt like it was flipping kind of back and forth, and kind of, and when I say flipping back and forth, guys, I mean it was kind of going like almost like an old like film reel would go through a piece of film. It's kind of going back and forth.
It looks like it was trying to come into focus and stuff,
right?
And
yeah,
in and out of focus on that.
Yeah. So that's my interpretation. It's perception versus reality, and like an ingrained reality, or an ingrained, excuse me, perception fighting the reality almost.
So then do you think that Ellie is someone who would be considered in this type of storytelling somebody who's sensitive, because obviously she has seen her mom's ghost also?
Oh, it's laid out right from the beginning. Right from the beginning, Grandma says that Ellie can see things in a certain way.
Okay.
Yeah, Grant mentions that right.
So not everybody that's in this house is going to see that same stuff. Although I feel like some have, because Ms. Collins says they've had people leave in the middle of the night. So obviously this is a haunted house that some people are keying in on.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So but now back to the story here, the guys, the men show up and they're like basically begging her to kill Ms. Collins. And
to free them.
Yeah. Right. So Ms. Collins at that point breaks in and she also sees the spirits. Right. And that's when like spirit world and real world start to get like mixed, because Jack Jack steps up and like smacks her, because Jack's one of the ghosts, right? Mm-hmm. He steps in, like he just like whaps her, right? How did he hit her, right? How did he do that? Like physically, the ghosts can manipulate
reality.
Same way
he gave Ellie a hickey,
I suppose. Oh, that's creepy. Oh God, it's a ghost hickey. I didn't even think of that. It's not from a dream. It's a fucking ghost hickey. Oh God. Oh, that's just wrong. That's fucking wrong. God damn it, Edgar Wright. Anyway, Oh God. Oh, that's weird. That's like, that makes me think of Ghostbusters where like where Ray has like sex with the ghost, right?
Remember yeah. So this whole scene is really interesting because we start seeing past and present merging in.
Yeah.
You see Sandy and Miss Collins kind of going back and forth, and you see the ghosts coming in and they start coming clear. So it was a really interesting visual scene happening here when then you've got the flames going all around too.
Yeah, the whole thing is very striking. Yeah. So okay, so the cops start to show up, and Ms. Collins, Sandy, is going to try and cut her own throat, but Ellie stops her and tells her she knows why she killed the men. But Sandy tells Ellie to leave and take John and get out, and she stays in the house and burns. Mm-hmm. Right. So we cut to an undetermined amount of time later, and we see that Ellie is being showcased at a fashion show, her work, right? Which is, again, looks like to me inspired by her 60s stuff, the 60s mm-hmm. fashion, right? And she's, you know, she goes and meets her boyfriend, John, and her grandmother backstage. And then she sees her mom's spirit in a mirror, right? Mm-hmm. But then we see a vision of Sandy. So Sandy's still in her head.
Yeah.
Is Sandy possessing her now? Is she?
I don't
Sandy?
Think so. No.
Wouldn't that be okay? So the natural progression for me, of course, schlock that I am, the natural progression for me would be for her to go on a killing spree as Ghost of Sandy.
This right? isn't a slasher Sandy. Film.
I know, but I know, but it's got she's a fucking mass murderer. She's a mass murderer. How is it not a slasher film? She stabbed. Well, I don't know how many men she stabbed.
It's not like a slasher film that has to have 8 sequels. Let's just do this one movie and that's it. Let's not
I do agree. A sequel. I agree. That's why I said that I was a hack. You know? So, okay. So anyway, that's the end of the movie, by the way, guys, just so you know. So you're not waiting for me to try and finish the rest of that. But the actress who plays Ellie, her name is Thomason. Mm-hmm. Thomason McKenzie, right?
Yep.
Anya Taylor-Joy's first film role was a character named Thomason in The Witch. Mm. Do you remember The Witch? The one that you hated that I loved?
Barely.
The one with the goat. Black Phillip. No.
I didn't like that movie, so I tried to put it out of my mind.
What a great flick. Guys, it's a great flick. Jen hated it. It's guaranteed to be good. I'm just kidding. So I already mentioned.
Thanks.
I already mentioned that Diana Rigg was the one and only Bond wife, right? But so something else that I noted was that this movie is made by Universal Studios, and they have a little shindig every October called Halloween Horror Nights. And this would make a great fucking HHN house.
Make
a great HHN house.
It would be a lot of fun.
Imagine
60s music playing through it.
60s music, the mirrors. People, you'd have to hire like a bunch of like twins to play like, you know, to play Sandy here and there, you know? So like, or at least do them up to look like
they just do makeup.
Oh man, that like, this would be fantastic. It would be great.
No, it would be a lot of fun.
I hope that they make an HHN house out of this. So you said you had other stuff.
I do. I have a few other things. I want to talk first about the foreshadowing. So we already talked about the smell comment that she made.
And another one. The taxi thing. Yeah, where he tells her, stay out of the street, you're going to get hit by a taxi. And
then Yeah. No, I'm talking about the foreshadowing that Sandy is Miss Collins.
Oh.
On here.
Okay. What else you got?
At the beginning of the movie, Sandy and Ms. Collins say the name or say the address that they live at in the same manner. So it's said the same way. So apparently it's a little different. I don't remember how it's said, but that's one of their clues they threw in there.
Okay.
Another one is when we first meet Sandy, the song that's being played is Anyone Who Had a Heart by Cilla Black.
Okay.
And that song is also playing in the house when Ellie goes in to tell her that she's leaving.
Oh,
same song is playing.
Well, that's just before we find out that she's Sandy.
That is literally just before. Another thing that happened right before is the mail. So she's going through the mail and the address. So she's flipping through the mail.
Alexandra Collins. Yeah.
And it says Alexandra Collins, and she gives her name as Alexandra
at one point, beginning. Yeah. She, like, so she, because in all of those names that she gives to those Johns in that montage scene, mm-hmm. are variations on Sandy, Alexandra, Alex, Lex, Lexi, Sandy, yeah. Sandra. They're all variations on it. And they just, they're all like, oh, that's a lovely name. But yeah, yep. I picked up on that as well. But by that point, I already had made my determination.
You had already known. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. And then in the library, when she is looking through that microfiche stuff, mm-hmm. the only thing she's finding is articles about missing person cases regarding men.
Right.
So yeah. she's actually looking without knowing at Sandy's murder victim or who she's murdered.
Wow. You can call them victims. They're still victims.
Yeah, yeah, they're still victims.
Even though they're Johns to her, to Sandy, but mm-hmm. they're not like, they're not the ones that forced her into prostitution. That was what's his name?
Right. So these missing stories are about these men. And then that's why the men come to the library, is because she's looking through this and that's why they show up at the library.
So this is less a haunted house story than like a haunted person story.
Yeah, I think so. I think
because
so.
they tend to show up wherever she is, right? They're in the, mm-hmm. are they in the pub? Didn't they show up in the pub at one point?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're in the
pub.
That
was the part where that, did she have a weird drink? Did she not have a weird drink?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So they're at the pub, they're at the
library.
They're at, you know, they're in Sandy's house. They're everywhere. Right.
Yeah. Yep. The end credits, you see a deserted, empty central London flashing up through there. They actually did those shots during the COVID-19 pandemic because the streets were empty, and that's how empty the streets actually were. So they actually took shots during the COVID lockdown and they put those in the end credits.
That was nice. I thought those shots were really cool. I was impressed by that. Usually right. you have to try and block off, like in order yeah. to block off like London, like to get permits to block off streets is notoriously difficult in London. In fact, in Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later, they accomplished a minor feat in getting stuff blocked off so that they could show deserted streets. Mm-hmm. They don't normally hand out like the ability to do that. So being able to get deserted streets is a treat without having to even get a permit really yeah. to do the blocking off.
They were saying in some of the other shots where she's walking, where they're following through and walking, there's a lot of people there.
Yeah.
They had like a steady cam on some kind of like rig setup that they mm-hmm. were riding through. And so a lot of people didn't even know they were extras in a movie scene that were walking by. So
wow.
They didn't actually clear the streets. They just, here we go. Let's go.
Wow. They dicked a whole bunch of people out of money. Shit.
So for anybody who is a Harry Potter fan, we have a couple Harry Potter actors in here. In the scene where Eloise and Sandy do that first mirror thing and there's the coat attendant, that's actually James and Oliver Phelps playing opposite mirrors. So that way they didn't have to do a special effect thing. So
Harry Potter nerdery.
I had to add that in there. You all know, right.
That's not all that uncommon though, to get twins to do stuff like mm-hmm. that. They did that in the Terminator yeah. 2 movie as well. Like in Terminator 2, sure. they had the two guys that looked alike playing the Terminator version of himself and himself in the cop scene. There's
well, it makes sense.
It does. Yeah. It works out really well. You save on digital all effects. Right.
The last thing I want to talk about is Edgar Wright has frequently stated that he would love to direct a James Bond film.
Please, God, yes, let him do it.
So there's references to different James Bond movies.
I mean, like Thunderball being right in the front. Like when you walk into the 60s the first time, a giant marquee for Thunderball. It was fantastic.
Yep. So you have the marquee ad for Thunderball.
Mm-hmm. You have Diana Rigg.
The Vesper is a cocktail from Casino Royale.
Also the name of his girlfriend in Casino Royale, Vesper Lynd.
All right. So Margaret Nolan is in here and she played Dink, who was in Goldfinger, I guess.
Okay. All right.
And then you've mentioned Diana Rigg.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there is someone they dressed up at the Halloween party to have the Dia de los Muertos costume that Daniel Craig had in Spectre.
Oh, really?
So it doesn't, you know, nothing real huge, but definitely little things hints in here. So yeah, that way, you know, maybe he's really trying to push like, hey, I really want to do James Bond. I'm going to just keep putting stuff in my movie.
Boy, I hope the Broccoli's decide that he can do it, because now's a good time. You know, now's a good time because they're switching Bonds. Get Edgar Wright in there. Go a different way. Holy shit. Can you imagine a Bond movie directed by this dude? Oh, Lord. That'd be great. That'd be great.
And that's all the notes I have.
Perfect.
Do you have anything else?
I got nothing else. I think I blew my load throughout this entire podcast, guys. I talked about everything that I wanted to talk about, the reflective shots, how a lot of things mirror each other throughout the entire film, from script to characters to shots and everything. I talked about the cinematographer early on. I don't have much else to talk about. Do you, Jennifer, think that you would rent, keep, or erase this one?
This was very easy for me. This is a keeper. I really like this movie. I actually watched it again the next day. So we watched this a couple days ago. I watched it again yesterday. And then between the two, it just kept coming back to me. And I was thinking about this scene or that scene, mm-hmm, or how that looked. And it was really visually stunning. Mm-hmm. Had a lot of fun music. There was a lot of fun moments. And then yet there's a mystery and a little scariness to it. It's got lots of stuff in it. I loved it.
Absolutely. Yes, for all those reasons and more, I 100% agree with you. Edgar Wright is a great storyteller, both visually and with the written word. I don't think there's a movie that he's made or a TV show that he's made that I haven't enjoyed. Every single thing that he's done so far, I've thought has been amazing. And this is no different. It has problems. Don't get me wrong. Terrence Stamp's character, Lindsay, is just deliberately sketchy for no reason other than I need to be deliberately sketchy to move the plot along. That's a major issue. But it's completely overshadowed by his choice of cinematographer and that cinematographer's work. I'm won over completely by how he merges his music selections into his films. You've seen Baby Driver, right? You know how he does this. He did it again in this movie. There's the first night Ellie is in her new place. Every movement she does is coordinated with the music as if it's like a dance. The actual art of the film frame is a dance set to that song. It's phenomenal. I couldn't recommend this higher. This is a great flick. I enjoyed the hell out of it. Definitely a keeper for me as well.
Excellent. Shall we talk about next week?
I don't know. Should we?
All right. Next week, we are going to cover the Netflix movie, The Irishman.
The Irishman. That dude, what is Irish? This one we pre-recorded, guys. We're taking a week off because it's tax season and Jen's tired. So we'll take a week off and you can listen to a pre-recorded episode. So it might sound a little different. I don't think we were doing this new version of our plot stuff by that point. I can't remember if we were or not. I don't remember. Yeah. I think I was still in the point where I was like, let me read you the whole plot and then we can discuss it. That whole thing, my old shtick, as it were, I like what we're doing now, where we're going through it and talking about it and having a real conversation rather than one or the other of us dictating to the other. I just think it works out so much better. So hopefully you folks are enjoying listening to that as well. But if you don't, we're going back to the old ways for a little bit. And then we'll be back to this after we get back to what's after that. Uncharted, I think we're going to be doing Uncharted.
No, Paranormal 6 is after that.
Oh, God. Yeah, Paranormal Activity 6. That, that one is definitely of the old ilk.
Yes, yeah. That one is. Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. So, all right, guys, that's it. So next week, right here on the couch, The Irishman, and we'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to A View from the Couch. We value your feedback. Please consider leaving us a review on Podbean, iTunes, or your preferred podcast listening app.
You can reach us on Facebook by searching at A View From The Couch, on Twitter at View_Couch, or by emailing us at aviewfromthecouch@yahoo.com. Thanks again for listening. Bye.
See ya.